Welcome back to the Deep Dive. The title of today's Deep Dive is The Federal News Update for Tuesday, November 18th, 2025. I am Alex Johnson, your guide, and we are ready to unpack the high-velocity actions and decisions taken across the entire U.S. federal government over the last, 48 hours.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. Today, we are really diving deep into a period defined by just sheer velocity. Our mission here is to go way beyond the headlines.
It feels like we have to.
We do. We're aiming to give you a comprehensive, nuanced, and really detailed report on every major activity since the start of Monday, November 17th. We're going to talk about the immediate impacts, the long-term implications, and how these actions that seem totally disconnected.
Right, from the definition of a puddle to the sale of a fighter jet.
Exactly. How they're all reshaping Washington and the world. And Monday was it was a day marked by huge executive decisions, landmark Supreme Court orders, and these massive shifts in regulation, especially around the environment, foreign policy, and that critical intersection of tech and national security.
You can just feel the decisiveness coming from the executive branch. And I mean, nothing captures that kind of unilateral speed quite like a massive military hardware deal that completely upends decades of foreign policy.
Right.
Let's start with that seismic shift. The one coming out of the White House and the DOD on the F-35 fighter jet sale to Saudi Arabia.
This is so much more than just a big sale. It's really a strategic reset. On Monday, President Trump announced he would greenlight the sale of F-35 advanced fighter jets to Saudi Arabia.
And the timing here is no accident.
Not at all. It was timed perfectly ahead of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's highly anticipated visit to D.C. this week. It's actually his first in 7 years.
And for anyone who doesn't follow this stuff obsessively, the F-35 isn't just another plane. It's really a policy instrument.
It is. Each one costs around $100 million. And more importantly, it's one of the most advanced stealth fighter jets ever built. Up until this very moment, Israel was the only country in the entire Middle East to possess this technology.
And that was by design, right? That reflects the longstanding U.S. commitment to maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge, or QME.
Exactly. And the QME doctrine, it isn't just a suggestion. It's actually enshrined in U.S. law. It requires the Pentagon to ensure that any major weapons package sold to a regional partner doesn't risk Israel's security.
So by announcing the sale, the administration is making a very clear, very conscious decision.
A conscious decision to potentially diminish that qualitative edge in favor of cementing this massive strategic partnership with Riyadh. I mean, this fundamentally changes the military balance in the region.
So what was the primary justification given for making such a radical break from decades of policy? It really sounds like the Iran calculus is just driving everything here.
It absolutely is. Huh. Trump framed Saudi Arabia as a great ally, and he explicitly credited them with being helpful in the U.S. strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities back in June.
So it's a quid pro quo, basically.
He essentially said, they've proven their worth as partners against our biggest adversary, and this sale is the reward and the ongoing commitment. His direct quote was, they want to buy. They've been a great ally. Look at the Iran situation in terms of obliterating their, we obliterated their nuclear capability. We will be doing that. We will be selling F-35s.
Wow.
This one decision just cuts through years of internal and congressional debate, and it prioritizes that immediate counter-Iran axis over the traditional QME concerns.
That is unilateral foreign policy delivered at an incredible speed. And speaking of high-speed unilateral action, the president made some comments on Monday that significantly raised the stakes on border security. He explicitly mentioned the potential for military force inside Mexican territory.
This was, arguably the most jarring foreign policy statement of the day. President Trump stated he is open to launching strikes inside Mexico if necessary to thwart drug smuggling to the U.S.
And his quote was?
His quote was, whatever we have to do to stop drugs. This kind of rhetoric, it elevates drug trafficking from, a law enforcement problem into a national security crisis that demands potential military intervention in a sovereign nation.
And this statement, it needs to be seen in its broader context, right? Because the administration has already been talking about rising tensions, specifically involving Venezuela.
Precisely. This rhetoric comes amid weeks of, military buildup and political tensions with Venezuela. Trump explicitly linked the need for aggressive security actions to Venezuela, dumping hundreds of thousands of people into our country from prisons.
So the signal is crystal clear.
It is. The administration is willing to entertain extraordinary measures, including military action, to stop what it defines as a security crisis on the southern border, and it's willing to bypass traditional diplomatic solutions to do it.
That assertive posture, It plays directly into the geopolitical maneuvering the administration is undertaking, which also includes the complex world of sanctions. We saw pretty significant updates from Treasury and State targeting both Russia and North Korea.
Right. Let's start with that delicate tightrope walk that Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, is doing with the Lukoil sanctions.
This is a textbook example of targeted sanctions coupled with what you could call necessary mitigation. OFAC updated several general licenses related to U.S. sanctions on Russia. The key action here is granting these really generous extensions to help with the sale of certain Lukoil assets.
So they're extending waivers for Lukoil International.
Right, their foreign business. Those waivers were extended until December 13th.
But the really interesting detail, I thought, concerns Bulgaria, an EU ally.
Absolutely. The waivers for transactions involving Lukoil's Bulgarian assets, we're talking the refinery, the distribution operations, those were extended all the way to April 29th, 2026.
That's a massive runway. It's a huge runway. And you have to ask why. Lukoil is trying to divest these assets without collapsing local energy markets. This long extension, it ensures the uninterrupted operation of these critical assets during the sale negotiations. It prevents economic instability and, you know, potential energy shortages for a NATO ally like Bulgaria.
So, on one hand, sanctioning Russia, but on the other, surgically granting exemptions to protect an ally's energy security.
That's the tightrope, exactly.
And moving from managing Russian energy to targeting North Korean finance, we see sanctions really zeroing in on the regime's reliance on digital currency.
Yeah, and this just shows how financial warfare is changing globally. OFAC published notice of a sanctions action. It was issued earlier in November, but publicly released on the 17th, and it adds three North Korean individuals operating in China and Russia to the specially designated nationals list, the SDN list.
And these individuals, CHOE, Yu, and Jiangnam, they're linked to known blocked entities.
Correct, like Koryo Commercial Bank.
But the technical specificity of these sanctions is what's fascinating. They aren't just freezing bank accounts, they're targeting crypto wallets.
Precisely. That is the most important detail here. Their property, including numerous cryptocurrency addresses, specifically USDT addresses used for stablecoin transactions, are now blocked. This is a direct response to the fact that North Korean cyber actors have stolen hundreds of millions of dollars in crypto over the last few years.
And they use those funds too.
To finance their strategic priorities, especially their weapons programs. It lets them get around traditional banking sanctions. So blocking these specific digital currency addresses, it criminalizes any transaction with those wallets globally. And it just underscores the administration's focus on cutting off the regime's digital finance lifeline.
Okay, shifting focus one last time in this geopolitical overview. Let's turn to the Middle East and that critical UN Security Council action on Gaza.
On Monday, the UN Security Council successfully passed a U.S.-backed resolution. It supports President Trump's recently announced peace plan for Gaza.
And this resolution is vital because it moves the plan out of the realm of just, you know, political talk and into a formalized international legal framework.
Right. It gives it teeth.
So what are the immediate tangible implications of this resolution passing?
Well, the resolution establishes two really critical pillars for what they're calling the next phase of the Gaza plan. First, it provides the international legal framing for an international force to provide security in Gaza. That's a necessary step to fill the security vacuum once hostilities cease.
And the second pillar.
Second, it supports establishing a technocratic committee for civil administration. But, and this is the big but, this support is contingent on the Palestinian Authority fully implementing its reform program.
So it's using international support as leverage to force reforms within the PA.
Exactly. It's leverage to compel the PA to modernize and reform its governance structure. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Michael Waltz, stressed that this is a significant step towards a stable Gaza, one that's united in rejecting terror.
So, having projected influence and dictated terms abroad through military sales, sanctions, UN resolutions, let's turn our attention to the state of the administrative engine back home, which is still sputtering after that 43-day government shutdown.
Sputtering is a good word for it.
We have to start with the Federal Aviation Administration.
The FAA and the Department of Transportation, they announced a significant, if fragile, step toward normalcy on Monday. They ended all flight reductions at major U.S. airports, effective at 6 a.m. Eastern, officially reinstating normal operating levels.
Normal operating levels is a relief, I'm sure, for travelers. But we shouldn't forget the scale of the chaos we just went through. What did that shutdown cost us in just basic functionality?
The shutdown was just catastrophic for aviation reliability. Because of staffing shortages, the FAA was forced to mandate flight reductions of up to 6% at 40 major airports just to maintain safety margins.
And that resulted?
It resulted in over 9,500 flight cancellations and tens of thousands of delays across the entire system. And while cancellations did drop below 1% over the weekend, which allowed them to lift the restrictions, the underlying system is still fundamentally weak.
How weak?
The FAA admitted it is still approximately 3,500 air traffic controllers short of its staffing targets.
3,500 controllers short, that speaks volumes about the long-term systemic damage, regardless of whether a resolution was passed to end the shutdown. And this is why Congress is getting involved.
Exactly. The Senate Commerce Committee is holding hearings this week, focusing on Wednesday, to investigate the long-term impact of that shutdown on aviation safety. And they're going to be looking heavily at controllers' pay and retention, acknowledging that this isn't just a temporary hiccup. It's a deep-seated federal workforce crisis.
Okay, now let's move to a massive regulatory shift. Arguably the biggest domestic action of the day. The redefinition of waters of the United States, or WOTUS, by the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers. This is where the administration makes its biggest statement about, well, dismantling the administrative state.
This is the absolute cornerstone of the environmental rollback agenda. On November 17th, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin and Assistant Secretary of the Army Adam Telly signed a pre-publication version of a proposed rule revising the definition of WOTUS under the Clean Water Act.
And their stated goal is what?
The explicit goal is to adhere strictly to the Supreme Court's Sackett v. EPA decision from last year, which drastically limited the scope of federal protection.
The core political fight over WOTUS has always been about property rights versus environmental protection. If you're a farmer or a developer, you want fewer federal waters. If you're an environmentalist, you want more. So what are the key technical changes in this new proposed rule?
They are dramatic. They substantially shrink federal jurisdiction. First, they remove interstate waters as a standalone category for federal jurisdiction.
Just gone.
Gone. Second, they strictly limit jurisdiction to relatively permanent waters. That means they have to be flowing continuously, or at least during the wet season. Temporary bodies of water are, for the most part, out.
But the greatest impact, from what I've read, is on wetlands. They've been historically protected, even if they only touch a stream intermittently. How does the new rule handle wetlands?
This is the critical change, and it's strictly following the Supreme Court's direction. Under this proposed rule, wetlands are jurisdictional only if they have a continuous surface connection to jurisdictional waters.
And that requires meeting a very stringent two-prong test.
It does. It essentially narrows the definition of connection down to constant physical contact and hydrology.
Okay, let's break down that two-prong test in simpler language, because this legalistic phrasing can get really dense. What does continuous surface connection actually mean for a landowner?
It means that for a wetland to fall under federal protection, it has to satisfy two conditions at the same time. First, it must be abutting or touching a relatively permanent water source, like a perennial river or stream. That's the geographical connection.
And the second condition?
Second, and this is the new high bar, it must have surface water, at least during the wet season. So you can't just have saturated soil or water under the surface. You have to have visible water touching the jurisdictional stream during the wet season. If water only flows subsurface, that protection is lost.
That is a massive shift. It's essentially requiring a constant physical or surface connection, severely limiting protection for isolated or temporarily disconnected wetlands, which often serve as vital natural filters.
Exactly. And the rules for ditches and farmland also clarify this reduced scope. Ditches are only excluded if they were constructed or excavated entirely in dry land. If you dug a ditch in a pre-existing swamp, it might still be regulated.
And for farmland.
For farmland, specifically prior converted cropland, it's excluded unless it has been abandoned. And they define that as not being used for agricultural purposes for over 5 years, leading to its reversion to wetland status. And they're clarifying that USDA documentation, like crop records, can be used to prove that active agriculture prevents that abandonment.
The implication here is just enormous. Environmental groups are arguing this rollback is catastrophic for water quality.
It is. Environmental groups point out that 53% of wetlands in the lower 48 states has already been lost. And this rule ensures federal protection will apply to far, far fewer remaining acres. They stress that sacrificing these natural filters for permitting efficiency means a greater risk of flooding and increased costs for cleaning drinking water downstream.
But property rights advocates are cheering this.
Oh, they're celebrating. They argue this provides the clear, predictable jurisdictional lines they've demanded for decades, reducing the burden of federal oversight and permitting requirements that often stall projects for years.
From water regulation, let's pivot to public health. The Department of Health and Human Services, led by Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., seems to be embracing AI and, well, revisiting decades of conventional dietary wisdom.
HHS had two significant announcements on Monday. First, a major financial commitment to AI in health research. HHS announced it is doubling AI-backed funding specifically for childhood cancer research.
And how did Secretary Kennedy frame that?
He framed this as part of the administration's effort to harness American innovation in artificial intelligence to find cures for pediatric cancer and ensuring that state-of-the-art science is being leveraged by NIH Director Dr. Jay Bhattacharya and his teams.
That clearly ties the administration's tech focus to a high-impact public health goal. The second announcement, though, involves diet, and it's a policy reversal that is going to shake up nutritionists nationwide.
It certainly will. Secretary Kennedy announced the launch of the Food Allergy Fund's Microbiome Collective, which is a multi-million dollar collaboration dedicated to uncovering the root causes of food allergies. But then he also previewed new dietary guidelines with two shocking points.
Which are?
The guidelines will stress the importance of protein,
right.
And more dramatically, they are ending the war on saturated fats in this country.
Ending the war on saturated fats. That is a monumental break from decades of federal dietary advice that demonized saturated fats, driving Americans toward carbs and processed foods. I mean, this aligns with a lot of recent scientific reevaluations, but hearing it from the Secretary of HHS is just huge.
It signals a fundamental shift in how the government views nutrition, moving away from that fat-phobic stance that many now believe contributed to the obesity and diabetes epidemics. He also took a very unique approach to finding the root cause of the allergy crisis.
The one that's just surging.
Right. He noted the need to investigate an environmental toxin that became ubiquitous around 1989-1990 as a potential root cause for the allergy epidemic, tying it to widespread microbiome dysregulation.
That specific time frame, 89 to 90, suggests they are looking at a specific chemical, maybe a pesticide or an industrial shift that coincided with the explosion of these chronic immune and autoimmune diseases. It's an approach that looks beyond just treating symptoms.
It's a holistic approach, yes, and it reflects the Secretary's own personal experience. He cited that 5 of his 7 children have allergies and his frustration that existing research has failed to zero in on this specific environmental connection. He is now directing NIH to conduct those studies.
Okay, finally, as we wrap up this administrative section, we should touch on the ongoing financial health of the Postal Service, which continues to struggle despite some revenue improvements.
The USPS financial report update from November 17th really highlighted the continuing deep financial challenges. Operating revenue did hit $80.5 billion, which is a commendable increase of $916 million from last fiscal year.
What?
But the service still reported net losses totaling $9 billion, only a slight improvement from the previous year's $9.5 billion loss.
So they are making more money, but the structural costs are still leading to these massive, unsustainable deficits. What is Postmaster General Steiner, who came from FedEx, advocating for?
Steiner emphasized the need for aggressive cost-cutting, efficiency measures, and crucially, integrating AI into the USPS logistics network to optimize RIT and processing. He argued that the USPS needs more capital and the ability to borrow like its private competitors, noting they're limited by outdated statutes.
And what about the persistent concern over privatization?
Board Chair Amber McReynolds pushed back hard on that, stating unequivocally there are no proposals or plans to privatize the Postal Service. She highlighted that $20 billion has been invested in modernization over the past 4 years, and that a stabilized workforce means only a modest number of seasonal employees, around 14,000, will be needed for the busy holiday season.
From defining a ditch and reforming diets to modernizing the USPS, we have seen massive, often disruptive, domestic actions. Now we shift into what is perhaps the most urgent and complex area of federal activity: national security, technology, and the domestic threat landscape. guided by the newly released DHS Homeland Threat Assessment for 2025.
The 2025 Homeland Threat Assessment, or HTA, it provides a vital framework. It organizes evolving threats into four key pillars: public safety and security, border and immigration security, critical infrastructure security, and economic security.
And the main takeaway is?
The overwhelming conclusion is that the U.S. faces a complex convergence of threats. From violent extremists, both domestic DVEs and homegrown, HVEs, transnational criminal organizations, adversarial nation states, and malicious cyber actors. And these threats often combine to create vulnerabilities far greater than the sum of their parts.
Let's focus first on cyber threats to critical infrastructure, starting with the nation-state actors identified in the assessment.
The assessment explicitly labels the People's Republic of China, the PRC, as posing the largest and most dynamic espionage threat. The key finding here is their strategic goal. The PRC continues to pre-position on U.S. critical infrastructure networks.
And pre-positioning isn't just about stealing data.
No, it's about gaining access and embedding malware for potential cyber attacks during a conflict scenario. It would allow them to disrupt the critical functions that support our economy, our essential services, even our continuity of government.
It sounds like a deliberate long-term preparation for war. What about Russia and North Korea in the cybersphere?
Russia's focus is different. Their government-affiliated actors are concentrating on compromising the software supply chain. They try to plant malware into software updates or vendor systems that are widely used. This lets them use a single compromise as a springboard to gain access to countless victims down the chain.
And North Korea?
North Korean actors, as we discussed with the sanctions, they almost certainly continue to target financial entities and cryptocurrency to fund Pyongyang's strategic priorities and weapons programs. They rely on thousands of skilled IT workers globally who deliberately hide their location to avoid sanctions.
Beyond state actors, ransomware continues to be a crippling financial and operational threat, especially to critical sectors like healthcare.
Ransomware is a persistent menace. It's primarily motivated by financial gain, but it causes massive operational disruptions. The healthcare and public health sector, the HPH sector, remains disproportionately affected. It experienced an 18% increase in reported ransomware attacks in 2023.
And these attacks aren't just data breaches. They have real-world consequences for patients.
Absolutely. They've led to local and national-level disruptions to patient care. The HTA specifically references the massive attack in 2024 against the largest payment exchange platform for prescription drugs. It paralyzed pharmacies and providers nationwide for at least 2 weeks, demonstrating just how fragile that HPH ecosystem is.
The assessment also covers the evolving physical threats from foreign terrorist organizations, FTOs, and domestic violent extremists, DVEs. It seems like current global events are fueling these threats.
They are. FTOs like ISIS and Al-Qaeda are leveraging current events, particularly the Israel-Hamas conflict, to accelerate calls for lone offender attacks against critical infrastructure. They've specifically named diplomatic facilities and civil aviation.
And there's concern about insiders.
Right. The assessment noted concern about FTO-inspired insiders who already have access to critical infrastructure and might seek to exploit vulnerabilities from within.
And the domestic threat landscape remains highly volatile.
Extremely. DVEs, often motivated by anti-government, racial, or accelerationist ideologies, continue to encourage sabotage of the energy, communications, and HPH sectors. The HTA highlights concerning real-world examples, like the unattributed shootings targeting electric grid substations near Lansing, Michigan, which occurred repeatedly over an entire year. It just illustrates the persistent threat of decentralized domestic sabotage.
The sheer complexity of these threats, cyber, physical, domestic, foreign, it demands a legislative response. And Congress is actively stepping up on the technology front.
The legislative branch is urgently trying to grapple with the technological acceleration that DHS highlighted. H.R. 1736, the Generative AI Terrorism Risk Assessment Act, was reported by the House Homeland Security Committee on November 12th.
And this bill aims to mandate that DHS review and disseminate information regarding generative AI terrorism risks.
Exactly.
Because generative AI introduces massive risks: deepfakes, synthetic media, accelerating radicalization and influence campaigns. How is Congress trying to get this complex intelligence out there?
The bill specifically requires leveraging state and major urban area fusion centers, which are joint intelligence sharing hubs, and it mandates information sharing from other federal agencies with DHS. The idea is to create an immediate feedback loop so that local law enforcement and infrastructure operators understand how these advanced AI tools could be used against them rather than waiting for slow, formal reports.
That legislative push for AI safety converges sharply with a really urgent regulatory decision happening today at the FCC. This is the scheduled vote on whether to rescind the cybersecurity rules adopted after the infamous SALT Typhoon hack.
Right. That vote is set for today, November 18th, at 1 p.m. Eastern.
And this is highly contentious and political.
Very. The SALT Typhoon campaign, revealed in 2024, involved a devastating penetration of U.S. telecom networks globally. It wasn't just corporate espionage. It reportedly targeted the communications of high-profile political figures, including then-candidate Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
And U.S. officials attributed that hack to China.
To Chinese government-sponsored actors, yes. It was labeled the worst telecommunications hack in our nation's history.
But wait, the rules being rescinded were put in place specifically to prevent such a catastrophic failure. How can the administration claim an agile and collaborative approach is better when the failure was so spectacular? I mean, doesn't this regulatory rollback look dangerously close to negligence in the immediate shadow of that event?
That is the core conflict here. And you are right to highlight the spectacular nature of the failure. The current FCC chairman, Brendan Carr, argues that the original rules adopted by the previous administration were legally flawed. He says they exceeded the agency's authority and did not present an effective or agile response.
So their counterargument is fundamentally ideological.
It is. They prefer a voluntary, agile, and collaborative approach through federal-private partnerships. They believe heavy-handed regulation stifles innovation and is too slow to adapt to nation-state threats.
So it's the classic American debate. Regulatory imposition versus voluntary compliance. But played out in the context of the worst cyber breach in history, where the communications of political leaders were compromised.
Exactly. And former administration officials argue that voluntary partnerships are totally insufficient to counter sophisticated state-sponsored threats like China's, which have unlimited resources. They maintain that the rescinded rules were a critical step that required U.S. telecoms to meet minimum enforceable cybersecurity standards.
And the administration's rationale for pulling back?
Their rationale references the commission's recent engagement with providers and their agreement to take extensive steps to protect national security interests. But given the scale of the SALT Typhoon failure, trust in voluntary commitments is a very difficult position to defend.
From the high-stakes world of national security and cyber warfare, let's turn our attention to the judicial branch. The Supreme Court issued several critical orders on Monday, November 17th, impacting immigration, prison reform, and religious liberty.
We can start with the case Noam v. Al Otro Lado. The court granted certiorari, agreeing to review the legality of the metering or turnback policy for asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Metering being the policy where U.S. border officials essentially restrict the number of asylum seekers they process at official ports of entry, often forcing them to wait indefinitely or turn back.
That's correct. And the core legal controversy centers on a highly technical but fundamentally important legal fiction. Federal law guarantees a non-citizen who arrives in the United States may apply for asylum.
But the question is, what does arrives mean?
Exactly. Does that right extend to someone who has reached the physical port of entry but is stopped on the Mexican side? The administration argues that until they are officially processed and admitted, they have not technically arrived.
So the administration is trying to validate the creation of these legal limbo zones at ports of entry. By taking the case, what is the conservative majority court signaling?
They are signaling a very strong interest in overturning the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which had ruled against the policy. A reversal would dramatically validate the executive branch's power to manage border flow and significantly curtail the practical right to asylum based on the argument that the person hasn't completed the technical act of arrival in the eyes of the law.
Now let's discuss Hudson v. United States, a case about judicial limits on correctional facilities. The court denied certiorari, but the dissent raised a massive flag about the separation of powers.
Right, the court denied review, which leaves in place a 2019 federal court order that required New Orleans to construct a new facility for inmates with severe mental health needs. This is a crucial area because federal courts often intervene in prisons that violate the constitutional rights of inmates.
But Congress tried to stop this. This takes us directly to the Prison Litigation Reform Act, or PLRA, of 1995.
Exactly. The PLRA was Congress's direct attempt to curb the power of federal judges to issue these long-term, costly injunctions against state and local prisons, specifically stating that courts cannot order the construction of prisons.
And the dissent here was forceful.
It was. Justice Alito, joined by Justice Thomas, issued a dissent arguing that the lower court should have immediately terminated the New Orleans order because it directly violated the PLRA.
So according to the dissent, Congress passed a law telling judges they cannot spend money building prisons, but the courts proceeded to order it anyway, rendering the injunction, quote, illegal from the beginning.
That is the core of Alito's argument. He's saying this is a separation of powers issue. But the denial by the majority suggests that the court implicitly accepts that federal courts retain these broad remedial powers in extreme cases of constitutional deficiencies, like failing to provide basic mental health care.
So it's the ultimate tension, statutory text versus the judiciary's implied power to remedy constitutional violations when life and liberty are at stake.
It is. The court is saying implicitly that constitutional necessity may trump congressional spending limits in these specific severe contexts.
That is a fascinating legal and political tension. Finally, SCOTUS also addressed religious liberty in a public venue context.
The court denied review in Cambridge Christian School v. Florida High School Athletic Association. This concerned a high school that was denied use of a stadium loudspeaker for pregame prayer.
And by letting the lower court ruling stand.
By letting it stand, the court affirmed a key tenet of the Establishment Clause. When speech is delivered over a government-controlled loudspeaker at a state athletic event, it is considered government speech.
Which means it's subject to Establishment Clause restrictions. The government can't endorse religion.
Exactly. If the speech were truly private religious expression, it would be protected. But the court affirmed that the context of using a state-owned, state-controlled mechanism like a loudspeaker transforms it into government endorsement, making it subject to oversight. It really clarifies the line between private expression and institutional endorsement when you're using state resources.
This has been a heavy day for the courts, defining constitutional power, statutory limits, and border policy. Now we move from the relatively structured world of the courts and regulatory agencies to the highly charged and often chaotic landscape of political maneuvering and congressional internal conflicts.
And let's start with what has been described as a stunning capitulation by the White House, the reversal on the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files.
On Monday, President Trump reversed his month-long campaign to block the release of files linked to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and urged House Republicans to vote in favor of a measure that would force their release.
This was a rapid strategic U-turn. The push for transparency was driven by a powerful bipartisan effort using a discharge petition. And it was led by the unlikely pairing of Libertarian Representative Thomas Massie and Progressive Representative Ro Khanna.
And Trump reversed course only when it became clear the petition would succeed.
He did. He effectively framed the fallout as a Democrat problem and a counteroffensive against Democrat hoaxes.
So what was the political calculation behind this sudden embrace of transparency?
The political cost of blocking the files just became untenable. Representative Ro Khanna claimed the president was losing his MAJA base over previous attempts to block the files, arguing that the base felt the president was protecting a corrupt governing elite, the so-called Epstein class.
And Massey's take was pretty blunt.
It was. He characterized the reversal by borrowing the president's own language, saying Trump got tired of me winning.
And the context of this scandal isn't limited to the files themselves. It also involves the confinement of Epstein's co-conspirator.
That's the political catalyst here. There have been fresh whistleblower revelations about the confinement of Ghislaine Maxwell at the federal prison camp in Bryan, Texas. They suggest staff were waiting on Ms. Maxwell hand and foot.
Which raised serious political alarms.
It did. Alarms about potential leverage, preferential treatment, and the looming possibility of a commutation application. It made the White House extremely vulnerable to accusations of a cover-up. So by greenlighting the file release now, the administration preempts further political damage and shifts the focus back to Congress.
Shifting focus to internal congressional drama, the House dealt with a contentious issue of internal discipline involving one of its own members, Representative Jesus Che Garcia.
Yes. The House failed a motion to table or kill H.R.E.S. 178. That's a resolution condemning Representative Garcia for the controversial timing of his retirement announcement. The vote was very close, 206 yea to 211. Nay, meaning the resolution condemning him, now moves forward for further debate.
What was the specific maneuver that angered enough members to push for a formal condemnation?
Garcia announced his retirement only after the November 3rd filing deadline had passed. This timing ensured that his chief of staff, Patty Garcia, who was no relation, was the only candidate on the Democratic primary ballot in the race to succeed him.
A classic piece of machine politics.
Exactly. It guaranteed his chosen successor a clear path without facing any primary competition. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries defended Garcia, arguing he was a progressive champion. But the failure of that motion to table suggests a significant appetite within the House for holding members accountable for blatant political self-dealing.
We are also seeing workforce turmoil across the executive branch. FEMA is seeing a high-profile resignation.
David Richardson resigned as acting head of FEMA on Monday after 6 months in the role. This is just before Karen Evans' scheduled takeover on December 1st. Richardson was highly scrutinized for being notably inaccessible during the July 4th Texas flood disaster.
And his departure comes amid this larger debate about FEMA itself.
It does. There are discussions within the administration about whether the agency should be entirely eliminated or just reformed.
Meanwhile, Congress is busy scheduling oversight hearings to look into the long-term strains on the federal workforce and that emerging technology space.
Absolutely. The Senate Commerce Committee is scheduling hearings this week to investigate the long-term impact of the government shutdown on aviation safety, focusing heavily on air traffic controllers' pay and retention, a direct response to that systemic fragility we discussed.
And on the House side.
Concurrently, the House Energy and Commerce Committee scheduled a hearing on the safety of artificial intelligence, AI chatbots, which reflects the urgency to legislative branch to regulate and understand these new technological threat vectors.
And finally, a piece of news that directly impacts millions of Americans, a significant Medicare cost hike.
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, released a notice indicating that Medicare Part B premiums will rise by about 10% in 2026.
That's a substantial financial hit.
It is. It translates to an increase of over $200 per year for seniors and disabled enrollees. And this is happening against a backdrop of rising health care costs and ongoing debates over how the government will handle the impending expiration of Affordable Care Act subsidies. Critics argue this increase further strains household budgets already struggling with inflation.
And this news about Medicare costs, it takes place alongside a broader economic warning from Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, painting a pretty grim picture of domestic financial fragility.
Bessent's warning really contextualizes all the administrative stress we've discussed. He stated that sections of the economy are already showing signs of strain and stressed, that the Federal Reserve has to cut rates soon to avoid a downturn.
He's predicting a unique kind of recession.
He is. He anticipates that the next recession will be unique and potentially severe because the U.S. consumer is uniquely unprepared. Americans have little savings, high debt, and the recession will be marked by deep disillusionment. And he directly linked this economic pain to technological acceleration, stating that AI is encroaching significantly on white-collar work, threatening not just paychecks, but the relevance of vast segments of the workforce. It sets the stage for potential social unrest on top of economic pain.
Sam, looking back at the entire sweep of actions since Monday morning, the pivot on F-35 sales, the dismantling of environmental regulations via WRDIS, the administrative turmoil at the FAA, and that explosive political reversal on the Epstein files, it seems like the federal government is driven by two competing forces or philosophies at the same time.
That is the essential insight of this deep dive. The day's actions illustrate a massive, concerted effort to simultaneously dismantle the administrative state while systematically fortifying the security state through unilateral, decisive action.
Give me an example of each.
Well, the WOTUS rule shrinks the EPA's jurisdiction and reduces federal technocratic reach. That's the dismantling of the regulatory state. But at the same time, the immediate greenlighting of high-stakes military sales, the aggressive rhetoric about strikes in Mexico, the detailed DHS threat assessment, and the targeted sanctions. All of that reflects a massive focus on unilateral decisive action to project power and manage perceived threats. That is the fortification of the security state.
And the speed of this change is what's so disorienting. The agility we saw in the F-35 deal, or the immediate green lighting of the Epstein files release, it demonstrates speed and a willingness to reverse course when it's politically necessary.
Right.
But the underlying tension in the fundamental WOTUS definition debate, or the persistent FAA staffing crisis, suggests that core non-security administrative functions are struggling to adapt or find stability under this high-speed governing style.
The pace of governing is the defining characteristic of this moment. The executive branch is willing to reverse course on core political issues, as we saw with the Epstein files, if the political or strategic cost of holding the line becomes too high. And meanwhile, you see the Supreme Court wrestling with these fundamental questions of institutional power in cases like Hudson and Noem, trying to determine how far the law can bend to meet executive demands or justify judicial overreach.
So here is the thought I want to leave with our listeners today, based on this exhaustive report covering the full spectrum of federal activity. We have documented massive legislative turbulence, judicial constraint debates, and comprehensive foreign and domestic threats detailed in the Homeland Threat Assessment. Given all this, which branch of the federal government, executive, legislative, or judicial, currently appears best equipped to respond to these multiplying challenges with genuine agility and long-term strategic coherence?
That is the ultimate question we are left with. The executive branch is agile, but often unilateral and disruptive, as we saw with the F-35 sale. The legislative branch is attempting necessary oversight regarding AI and the FAA, but it's crippled by internal conflicts and political maneuvering. And the judicial branch is defining limits, but its actions are reactive and slow. The answer to which branch possesses both agility and coherence speaks volumes about where genuine strategic governance resides in Washington right now. An immense amount of information synthesized down to the fundamental questions of power and capacity. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Thank you. We look forward to analyzing the next wave of federal action with you.